Great. Thank you, Brian, and the rest of the selection committee for inviting me here today. I'm an assistant professor. My job is I was hired to be the sustainable fruit production systems specialist for Cornell. And in that role, I cover a number of different topical areas. So this morning I talked about my work with soil management and soil ecology. I also do some work with pollen tube growth in apple trees. And honestly, really, when I started my career, I thought I was going to be working in organic fruit production systems for most of my career. But as you'll see with the growth in the industry, my research focus and my teaching focus and my outreach focus on hard cider has grown with the growth of the industry. My appointment is 60% research and 40% teaching. And to give you some background on what hard cider is, because oftentimes you run into lots of issues with talking to people who are not familiar with it or just learning about it, and there's a lot of overlap in the terminology. So what I'm talking about today is the fermented product hard cider. And if you go to Europe, they just call it cider. Here in the U.S., you might hear it called hard cider or cider. And so it can be kind of confusing. Traditionally, our growers in the northeastern U.S. referred to cider being the sweet product that you'd go to when you did pick your own apples and you got cider donuts and you got a jug like it's shown there. But through fermentation, you make hard cider. There's a number of other products out there that are related. So there's cider, which is unfiltered generally. There's juice, which is the filtered products that we, you know, Mott's and et cetera, very clear. From hard cider, if you acidify it, then you have apple cider vinegar, which if you Google apple cider, all these health benefits of apple cider vinegar pop up, and that's a very popular health product right now. And then there's a number of different distillate products as well, eau de vie, Calvados, which is a brandy, and Pommeau. But I'll be talking about, when you hear me say cider today, I am talking about hard cider, fermented cider. You may also hear about Perry, and Perry is kind of a cousin of cider, and that is fermented pear juice. But I will not be talking about that today. So if we look at cider production globally, we see the Brits really like this product, right? So they consume almost half of all the cider produced in the world. The rest of Europe drinks about 20% of it, and then North America is at 10%, but growing rapidly. And so in the last 10 years, we've just seen this tremendous growth. We're up to about 820 producers now in the U.S. They're in every state. So there's a cider producer in Hawaii who came to visit me earlier this summer. There's several in Texas. There's producers in Florida. I mean, so that's it's really interesting, right? So traditionally apples are grown, right? Washington State, we think about Michigan, we think about New York, we think about other New England states and some others in the valleys of the eastern U.S., but we don't think about some of these other places as being apple-producing regions. So where are they getting their apples? So we'll get to that in a moment. So this is the growth trend. This is data from the U.S. government, and it's the cider volumes leaving bonded storage. So this is probably one of the best metrics for understanding the cider industry, because this is Uncle Sam saying when an alcoholic product leaves bonded storage, that's the point that he gets his cut. And so that's the best record that we have of sales of cider production. And so what we see in the gray bar is the domestic production since 2005. So huge increase. I mean, it was just astronomical growth of cider production starting in about 2011 and going on to about 2015. And so I got into it and I started doing research in hard cider just about 2011, because I started getting calls and growers were saying, hey, well, should I invest in this? Is this something worthwhile to do? And of course, very similar to the wine industry, we started seeing a lot of people who were coming into this as a second career. They were had a professional career, they've retired, or they're moving on for other reasons, and now they are interested in starting this. So they don't know anything about farming, they don't know anything about apple growing, they don't know very much about cider or fermentation science, and they're like, well, we're going to do everything. I'm going to plant an orchard, I'm going to start a cidery, I'm going to learn how to do small business management. And so there's a huge extension need or an outreach need in this all as well. And it's really, you take a lot of lessons from what they're doing on the wine side because they have to deal with this as well. So if we look at the amount of cider that left bonded storage in 2014 and 15, and we do some math on it, and we figure, well, this is about how many gallons of cider you can make per bushel. It was the equivalent of 18 million bushels. So that's 7% of all apples grown in the U.S. would have been made into cider into those years. Now, the it's not an accurate projection because a lot of the large-scale producers are importing apple juice concentrate to make their cider. And so that's where a lot of my research has come in and say, hey, well, we can have a domestic supply chain of high-quality cider apples. People can make estate-produced products, et cetera, from ciders. They don't need to be importing apple juice concentrate to do this. So the market's been growing. It's big. It's about 1.3 billion now nationally, maybe closer to 1.5 billion now. But small relative to beer, which is about 100 billion, and wine, which is about a $35 billion industry. So you saw a little slump at the end there. Is there a cider bubble? Is the bubble going to burst? Like the real estate market's going to burst? And so what we saw was a lot of that growth was some large-scale producers just basically putting their foot on the gas pedal and going for it. Particularly Angry Orchard, which is owned by Boston Beer Company, and so that's also Sam Adams, and so they had distribution channels, and they were able to get their product out there very quickly, capitalize on the fact that no one else was really doing this, saw an opportunity and took it. They took their foot off the pedal. There was a little bit of a slough in the market, but what we're seeing now in that wake is all these small-scale producers. So there's probably about Angry Orchard has about 60% of the market share in the U.S. in that there's probably about two more producers that make up another 25% of the market share, and then we have 15% of the market share, which is the other 800 producers. So a lot of small-scale producers. Recently, we're seeing this huge revival in rosé cider, pink cider, and that's really buoying the market right now. So that chart is showing number of new startups by year. So huge issue and a lot to address. So let's talk a little bit about what is a cider apple. We think about them a little differently than we think about culinary apples. And so there's kind of these two traditional metrics. One is the tannins. So this is a subset of polyphenols that lend themselves towards bitterness and astringency, and then acidity. And so if it's above this 2 gram per liter threshold, it's called a bitter apple. And if it's above 4.5 grams per liter of malic acid, then it's considered a sharp apple. So you get bitter sharps, bitter sweets, and so on down the list. So here's just some pictures of them. Unless you're familiar with the cider industry, you probably haven't heard of most of these apples: Dabinet, Brown Snout, Porter's Perfection. Really cool apple. It displays what's called polycarpy, so it will often produce these two fruits that are fused together, similar to like doubling in cherries. So one of the first projects we did when I was at Virginia Tech was say, okay, well, what's out there already in the industry that's being grown that can be used for cider, which has these attributes of tannins and acidity that the cider makers want. So we looked at this whole list of apples. Most of them are commercial. There was a few that we threw in there as of interest, saying, well, these are locally important perhaps for cider production. So that red bar through the graph is the 4.5 threshold for acidity. And we can see that with the exception of Fuji, Yaddo Reds, and Red Delicious, all of our apples, or most of our culinary and processing apples, are sharp apples. We have plenty of acidity in the apples that we're currently growing commercially. But when we look at the polyphenols, the tannins, and so these are the really important compounds that lend themselves to a more full-bodied, more robust mouthfeel in a product, we see that none of them reach that 2,000, which would have been 2 on the other, it's milligrams here, scale of a bitter apple. And only a few of them, and these are kind of the oddballs, Harrison, Hughes Crab, these are some local apples, even got close to 1,000 milligrams per liter. So we're really well shy of getting enough tannin, even in our commercial apples, to satisfy the needs of what the cider producers are saying they want. So what have we been doing? Some of the things, variety trials. I've got a number of different trials set up on our research farm and other farms. We're looking at about 40 different varieties now. We're importing varieties from England, Spain. I'll be looking to do another importation from France in the near future for some of the Calvados varieties. So, you know, what looking at all this germplasm, and you can see on the left, some of these are really, you don't know about them because they are terrible to grow. They have fruit cracking, rot issues, and that's fire blight on the bottom there, which is terrible for a lot of these varieties, which tend to be very late blooming. Some more issues with them. Rots, blindwood, you know, areas of the branch with no fruit buds on them and very small fruit size. And they tend to bear fruit in very tight clusters. It makes them very hard to thin. So we're also looking very broadly. This is Nathan. He's giving a presentation this afternoon, and it's worth going and checking out what he did. He's looked at about 160 accessions at the USDA's germplasm collection for their potential use in cider. So everything from red-fleshed varieties at the bottom that could be used for rosé, some species like on the top there as a Malus species for their potential use in the cider industry. And when we put it in this bittersweet, bitter sharp categories, we can see that there's a number of accessions that have the potential to have the amount of tannins and polyphenols that we want that perhaps are not being grown right now and perhaps aren't even on the top list of our growers because they're not familiar with them. So we're really excited. I've got Nathan just graduated. I have a new graduate student who's going to be starting, and we're starting to actually associate these traits with genetic markers. So we're working with a colleague at Cornell. We looked at the acidity genes in these, and now we're going to be able to come up with, hopefully, a way of doing like a fast throughput marker-assisted selection process. So a new grad student is going to be starting, and he's going to be looking at the polyphenol aspect of that as well. So other questions. There's so many questions about growing cider apples. There's so many things that we look at our colleagues who do viticulture and enology that they ask about, how do we improve wine quality through our practices in the field? And so we haven't really looked at that in the apple industry, right? We've looked at it in terms of how do we make the apples bigger, how do we make them redder, how do we make them sweeter, and that's kind of where it stops mostly for the culinary apples. You know, there's some other attributes that are important, but that's it. And that's a different product, even though it's the same crop, than what we're looking at for cider. We have different quality attributes. So what can we do in the field to improve the quality of the final product? Rootstocks, training systems, crop load. This is Adam Carl. He's a graduate student with me. He gave a nice presentation about some of his nitrogen fertilizer work on Tuesday, and this is another project he's working on, is what impact does light levels have on polyphenol development in apples? So we have different levels of shading on the tree, and we're looking at that as well. So one of the kind of threads of a little story that I'm really interested in is nitrogen utilization from the orchard to the bottle. So Adam's work was looking at, we fertilize the trees, how does that affect things like fruit quality? And so what's really important for cider apples is that they have enough amino acids in the juice for fermentation. Because when you don't have enough amino acids in the juice, which is called, the wine industry calls this as YAN, yeast assimilable nitrogen, then the yeast will start reducing sulfur compounds. And so they produce hydrogen sulfide, which is H2S, which is that rotten egg smell, which obviously is a a flaw, right? It's something we don't want to be smelling when we're trying to consume a alcoholic product. So number of projects, we have Adams Project, been collaborating a lot with Amanda Stewart at Virginia Tech, and we're looking at which specific amino acids are really important. So we find that methionine is really important. We looked at some things such as what are the effect of pre-harvest fungicide applications on this, you know, so right, yeast are fungi, and so if we have fungicides on the fruit, does that affect yeast fermentation? Does not, but we did that work to prove it. And I have a visiting scientist from China right now who's working on looking at the genes in yeast cells that are being upregulated when they're in a low nitrogen environment, so kind of a full circle. Another little storyline that we're working on is how crop load affects fruit quality for cider apples. So a lot of notions out there in the industry about how to grow these and, you know, do we have to do it like wine where you have to do a lot of thinning to get quality of the fruit and, or, you know, from my perspective as kind of, you know, when I'm looking, step back and objectively, I'm like, well, probably your goal is as many apples as possible that you can crop each year, right? Because it's a processing fruit in the end, and we're just looking for volume. So, but we're looking at this and trying to figure this out. So when we looked at the polyphenols from these treatments, this low, medium, and high crop load levels, we didn't find any differences in the juice, but we did find that in the fermented cider, we had higher levels of polyphenols in our high crop load treatment. So I thought that, well, that's probably related to fruit size. A little unclear as to why we didn't see that effect in the juice, but we did in the fermented cider, and we're continuing to look at that. So we have this project we've been going on for 3 years now, looking at 8 different cultivars under these different crop load treatments. This is a group of interns in the back who work with Cornell undergraduates, and they work with various faculty in viticulture and pomology over the course of the summer, and they've been helping with this project. Just some pictures from this, and what we see is there's a huge, pretty big variability in also the return bloom of these apples. A lot of these are very biennial, and so we're trying to select those out so that we recommend to growers that they have more annual cropping varieties. And then, but we're also seeing the opposite effect when we start compiling a larger data set in that the larger fruit are actually having more polyphenols. And so we're still trying to suss this out and have a new postdoc who's going to be specifically working on this issue. We've been looking at harvest and post-harvest management and how does harvest date affect the polyphenol level? How does storage affect the polyphenol level? So we have this manuscript in submission now. Questions, again, being asked by the wine industry over and over. When do we harvest the grapes for the best quality? So when do we harvest apples for the best quality for cider? And so we're trying to support that with research-based data. We've also been looking at the economics of this. We started doing this back when I was at Virginia and ran some economics. We developed an Excel spreadsheet that growers could use and they could enter in their own numbers. And I'd been promoting that for about 5 years and realized that, like, the growers don't do that, right? It's too much work. So I hired an undergrad ag economist student, and so we ran a number of case studies over the last year to actually do it for the growers, you know, went there to their farms, got the numbers and everything. It was the way we had to do it. So a lot of these operations can be profitable, and they can be profitable doing it at high density systems. So the Cornell's been very supportive of my program. They are, and the Cornell University Ag Experiment Station, we just planted about an acre of new cider, experimental cider apple orchard, where we'll be able to do a lot of this research and also develop tools for things like mechanical harvesting in cider apples. On the teaching side, I teach classes in pomology, but we developed a new class 2 years ago on cider production. We've had about 60 people go through that program in the last 2 years, and we also have a lab component. So it's often ranked as one of the classes the students find to be most fun, and that's because we serve them alcohol. And so we do about 40 minutes of lecture, and then the last 10 minutes we'll do a tasting, and we'll do it. It'll be ciders from Spain, or sometimes we'll do faults. You know, these ciders all have that rotten egg smell. And so I co-teach that with a food scientist who's a fermentation specialist. This year we did a really cool thing. We worked with the library and had them teach our students how to go in and edit Wikipedia. So how many people use Wikipedia, right? Raise your hands if you use Wikipedia. How many have used it within the last 24 hours? Well, you're here, right? I'm sure, you know. But usually we ask that, and everybody's like, yeah, I used it, I have. So we taught them how to go in and edit, and we went in, and we noticed that the cider page was just not very robust, and we worked on that to make that a lot better. Another little side project that I've done is we had a small grant from the library system at Cornell, and we were able to go back and digitize some rare manuscripts. So the most secure location I've ever been at Cornell University is the rare manuscripts collection. And you got to put everything into a locker, and you get a special code to go in. And so we were able to digitize 22 titles, and then we worked with a group called the Biodiversity Heritage Library. And so this is a free online website. It was actually an offshoot of the Smithsonian. And basically, they make old texts related to biology available for free. So they created a whole apple and pomology section for us, 64 titles with over 200,000 pages on it. And so I use this, actually. So the picture on the left is from one of the texts that we digitized from 1811. And that shows fox whelp, which is this prize cider variety. But it turns out that the one that we have available to us in the U.S. is incorrect. It's the wrong genotype. It's incorrectly named. So the growers call it faux whelp, F-A-U-X, faux whelp, fake fox whelp. And so that's a picture of it in the USDA germplasm collection there. And you can clearly see that the authentic one, drawn in 1811 is not the one that we have there. So part of this is also I've been collaborating with USDA scientists, and we've been doing some SSR fingerprinting. And so not only are we phenotyping this and visually comparing it to historic texts, but we're also using modern techniques and trying to actually find out what that faux whelp really is. And we haven't quite figured it out yet, but some fun detective work as well. And so so it's really a team. I think we're really developing a program at Cornell to make us the national leader in cider research and extension and education. Not to say I don't collaborate quite a bit with colleagues all over, but we have a website. We're going to do our first field day this coming Monday, and we have about 50 people signed up to come and check out some of our hard cider apple orchards. It's been fun. It's kind of something I never thought I'd get into in terms of my research. I just thought it'd be kind of a fun thing where I make cider in the basement as a grad student because it's a cheap way to make alcohol. But it's become largely, I'd say it's probably about 80%+ of my research program right now, which has been fun, and it's really quite exciting. So my lab group, I've gotten a lot of funding, and it's been... I just want to thank all those funding agencies for all of their support as well. So thank you.